Well, good morning, friends, neighbors, countrymen, non-countrymen, whoever you are, if you're listening to this radio station, I appreciate it. This is Lenny Lawson, the car guru, and we're here to talk cars and car stuff. Even if you're not interested in cars, I found that there's a lot of listeners who sound and like cars, Lenny, but I still listen to you. And I just can't for the life of me understand why. But anyway, we will move forward and talk about minimum wage right now. So how much should somebody make at a minimum? I remember, of course, you know, anytime somebody says, I remember when I was young, you know, that's when the ears tend to shut on the younger audience. But sometimes they'll listen if they are so compelled to. $15 minimum wage sounds a little high to me. I was earning about $1.65 an hour. Maybe it was $2.65. You know, as you get older, some things get bigger and some things get smaller. And, you know, it depends on how many times you tell the story. I used to get so exasperated with my dad because every time he told a story, it would change. And also, I heard the same story about 7.2 million times. But now I miss it. So, you know, just take that for what it's worth. I was listening to a podcast this morning while I was in the shower. I asked Alexa if she would play me a podcast. See, I've got an Alexa in my office, and right now it's turning blue. And
sorry, I don't know that.
Did you hear that? She said, sorry, I don't know that. But anyway, I asked her to play me a podcast, and it was about employment and how so many people are changing jobs now. Changing jobs, changing careers, or just quitting altogether. I don't know what they're going to do. I guess some people can subsist on the earth and grow maters and taters and stuff in their garden and just get along just fine. Well, but others of us, we need income. And I guess you go on welfare. I don't know what that's like. I know there's plenty of people that do and can't get along without it. But there are others, I truly believe, that can get along without it, just choose not to. But so what is it? What should you pay for talent? You know, one of the main things that I look for is certain attributes. I don't necessarily look for skills. If you're a technician, yeah, I need you to be certified. If you're a parts person, I need you to understand the automobile, all the different components and so forth. If you want to work in most semi-skilled or unskilled jobs and do a good job, it really has nothing to do with what you can do. It has to do with who you are and how you think and what do you believe in and how do you view work. You know, how do you approach different types of situations? There are personality profiles that you can take that are available commercially and to use to evaluate how people think and you know what's important to them, what they value, what their personal attributes are. Let me give you a couple. Like empathy, selflessness, authenticity, decisiveness, being personally accountable, being disciplined, courage, perseverance, adaptability, resiliency. You know, you can't gather all that information with just a casual interview. That's why I think a lot of companies do multiple interviews, but I still think most of those companies ask the wrong questions as well. There is a great book that I think everybody should be aware of. It's called The Attributes, 25 Hidden Drivers to Optimal Performance by a guy named Rich Deviney, and that's spelled D-I-V-I-N-E-Y. And I heard him speak at the Nissan meeting that I went to in Las Vegas, and he was you can read his history if you want to, but he's a Navy SEAL and did more tours than you can imagine in Afghanistan and Iraq, and has become a consultant and a motivational speaker, and he uses all of his situations and life experiences that he's been through to teach people how to be better leaders and better employees and be more effective in your daily lives. And I think that kind of stuff, you know, how often do your employees read books? It's amazing if you ask, if you're sitting in a room of 50 people and you have them raise their hands, how many people are reading a book right now? Not many hands will go up. People don't read anymore. They look at their devices, their cell phones and iPads and so forth. They don't really read. They're not students of whatever field they're in. Of course, in a lot of different fields, if you don't stay up on current goings on, then you're going to fall behind and you won't be able to retain your certification. Like if you're a doctor, maybe an engineer, attorneys, maybe they have to take follow-up tests. I don't know. If they don't, they should. But, you know, you have so many different types of jobs that don't require people to upgrade their skills. But if you're in sales or if you're in customer service or if you're in any type of management role, leadership, you need to read books about that and learn from the years and years of information that has been poured out there. It's just like Stephen Covey. I'm a Covey fan. Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. One of my favorite books is one of the habits is called First Things First, and it really had a big impact on me in my life. And I recommend that any person read it. It gets kind of tough when you get later on in chapters and stuff. If you're not typically a person who uses a planner, you may not like it. And that's another thing. You know, there's not a lot of people that really use a planner of any kind. A lot of people have to-do lists, you know, might be on a little legal pad or a post-it note or something like that. And I'm not saying that that's not an effective way for people to do it, but there aren't a lot of people that use a calendar and a planner. Like I try to sit down on, well, I don't try to, I do every Sunday night when things have settled down, I will get my planner out and I'll plan my week. Sometimes I have to start on Saturday, but I will plan the things that I know that I have to do. And on that plan, I'm going to make sure that I put time for my wife. And when I had young kids, time for my kids. And specifically, you know, what do I want to do with them? Because in reality, they're my first priority, or they should be. And if I put them first, then and those are the most important things in my life, then they deserve to be put first, don't they? So oftentimes our jobs and our hobbies and other things kind of get in the way of prioritizing the really important things. And, you know, Stephen Covey talks a lot about the difference between something being important and being urgent. And they say a lot of people suffer from something called the urgency addiction, which is just running from one thing to another and chasing your tail all the time and never getting the important things done. And then people wonder why their marriages fall apart or why they don't have a good talking relationship with their children. And it's because, or their employees for that matter. And that's because that they don't practice the things that deliver those kind of results. So, you know, you've got to pay attention to attributes when you're hiring people. You have to make sure that you have a tool to flesh those out, so to speak, and an interview process where you can find out, well, who is this person really? I mean, what do they do with their free time? Of course, a lot of it you can see on the false world of Facebook. You know, the imitation world, the world that you want other people to see about you. Nobody puts I guess some people put bad news, their bad news, their depressive thoughts and things like that on Facebook. I use Facebook to try to encourage folks, to try to witness to my faith. And, you know, of course I put family pictures and stuff. Got a lot of family members that go to Facebook to see what's going on with the Lawson clan in Greenville, Tennessee. But, you know, it's just, to me, it's and also to promote my business and to, you know, say what's good and what's going on at Gateway. I think it's interesting to some people. Other people say, I just want to buy a car and get service. I don't need any new friends. And I look at an opportunity to get out and meet people as an opportunity to make new friends. And so a lot of people don't view the world the same way. So anyway, we're all different. And you just have to recognize that, you know, how is this person going to fit into my organization? Because as everybody knows, you bring the wrong person into an organization, they can destroy it. And they can destroy from the inside, and next thing you know, you've got people leaving and defecting. I remember that happened to me one time. I'll tell you about it here in just a minute. Okay, I'm back. Yeah, I was... Sometimes you get oblivious to reality, don't we? I had a situation where I had a manager that I knew he was controversial, but I didn't realize how just despised he was by so many people because he was different with me, and we were actually friends. I mean, our kids played together, and we went out to eat occasionally. I try to avoid that as much as possible. I don't know why. I guess my dad just kind of said, you know, it's kind of hard to be somebody's boss when they're your friend, too. I've had to fire a few friends before, and that's no fun. But anyway, I went to lunch and came back from lunch, and one of the managers walked up to me and said, can you come back to the conference room? I said, well, sure. So I walked back in the conference room, and around the conference table are all of my managers, except one. And basically, their point was, if you don't take care of this guy, meaning terminate him, we're all going to leave. So I had a mutiny on my hands. Now, I don't think they would have left, but I think that they were making a point about, you know, the health of the organization and what one person can do to spoil it for everybody. And so I did the hardest thing that I've, that was the hardest termination that I've ever done because the employee felt like it was a betrayal of him on my part. And, you know, I just had to convince him, and I didn't. I failed convincing him. He left angry and never forgave me, I think. Well, you know, I think 20 plus years later, I think we started to get a little bit closer and talking and things like that. But I still felt like he always felt that I messed up by letting him go. But I didn't because the organization was healthier with him gone. It was just like a dark cloud had been lifted. And too often, isn't it hard to let somebody go like that? And it does take courage. And maybe I knew that he needed to go, and I just didn't do it. Because I was afraid to do it. I was afraid to act. And so I needed some urging. And that's why it's so important, I think, to listen to your employees and to talk to them on a more personal basis than just a transactional basis. Transactions happen every day where we're doing business, right? We're interacting on a business question, solving a problem, you know, kind of planning for the future, whatever, all these different types of interactions. But you never get to the point where you say, what's going on in your life? You know, how am I doing in terms of my job and how it affects you? You know, open yourself, making yourself vulnerable. And I do that with customers too. And I think that I have some very, very good long-time folks or long-term customers that will come back and just chew me out if they think I'm not doing something right or said, Lenny, I saw that ad and I don't know. I don't think that's really your image. Or they come in and say, you know, I've always had a great experience in your service, but not this time, you know, and I find out why and then I go intervene. I know sometimes my employees think that probably the only time I come to them is when I've got something bad to say. But that's not true, and I hate it when they say that. And I say, well, let's talk about that. Do you think that sometimes people just hear the bad more than they hear the good? They don't hear the compliment? I truly think that is true. Truly think it's true. I'll just have to patent that one. Okay, so the project that I've been working on, a 49-car hauler, this is a, as I've said before, it's a truck that is built on an F-450 chassis that I've stretched 7 feet so I could haul more vehicles on it and then glued it back together, put a bed on it, and put a 1949 truck body as a cab, which is going to be tight. I just finally found some seats that I think are going to work out of a 2014 Ford Mustang. And, you know, it's just like when you're building something like this, you can do anything. It's a blank canvas. You can do anything you want to. And it is a work of art when you get done. But I'm not the artisan. I am the brainchild. I'm the one who comes up with the ideas. And sometimes, though, my ideas suck. And so, sorry I said that, but anyway, it's true. And so the employee or the artisan will say, Lenny, have you thought about this? And I encourage that kind of input. So anyway, when we have a long-term project like this, things don't always go well. And so one of my main painter, my main body guy, made a big error in that he went ahead and painted the sides of this body, and it was not ready. When I showed up on Monday morning after being on my trip, he was out. He was having a dental visit, and I looked down the side of that bodywork, or the side of that truck body, and I said, nope, that's not going to work. It had more waves than the Atlantic Ocean. And so the body work that he did on the cab was fantastic. I mean, just people were amazed at it, but he really dropped the ball on the cab. So now he's got to do it over again. And we've got to discuss about how that's going to be paid for, because I pay these guys by the hour. And, okay, if somebody has to do something a second time because of an error, my philosophy has always, let's say an uncontrollable error, then I'll pay them for it. But if they cause the error and it's their fault and carelessness or whatever, then I'm going to make them either pay for it or contribute to it. Running a car dealership, occasionally you're going to have a cleanup shop guy or a technician is going to run into something. It's going to open a door on somebody else's car or something like that. And we don't know that stuff happens unless the employee confesses. And in my experience, they don't confess real often. They'd rather just kind of hide it. And that's unfortunate. And then the customer takes the vehicle home and puts it in their driveway and then walks out the next day and said, where'd that dent come from? That wasn't on there when I took it to Gateway. And so they come in and they're angry, and I get it. I understand. So what do I do? Well, I fix it. There's nothing else I can do. What am I going to do? Call the customer a liar? You know, that's real good for the relationship. So what we do is we solve the problem, and we try to figure out, you know, we have video cameras in the dealership, but you really can't see everything. And, you know, you try to work with the employees. Now, if they're out driving around and wreck somebody's car, then I have garage keeper's insurance to help pay for that. But it still creates a bad feeling on the part of the customer. And it would me too. I mean, I don't want somebody. I mean, if somebody's driving my car because that was part of diagnosing the problem or test driving to make sure it's done, and they have a fender bender, I'm not going to like it because I don't want my car painted. You know, I don't want it to show up on a Carfax. But folks, life happens, and it happens to car dealers as well. And, you know, you could just as easily run into somebody yourself, or, you know, it could have happened in a Walmart parking lot or whatever. It just happened here. And, you know, we're not going to give you stock in the dealership, you know, because we accidentally crashed your vehicle. We're going to fix it, and we're going to try to make you whole. And that's what insurance is for, and we're real sorry that we did it. But you just got to cut the dealer some slack when that kind of stuff happens. And, you know, don't defect from them. I'm not just talking for my benefit, any car dealer. It's an accident. It happens. You know, and it's your car, and I get it. And, you know, if there's some type of a problem where you can't get it fixed, you take it over and over again to get the dealership to fix it, and they can't seem to fix it, then that's a good reason to defect if they are, you don't feel like they're putting forth the effort. But if they are putting forth the effort, then, you know, you just have to give them a little leeway sometimes. So anyway, that's what my opinion is. And we'll be back here in just a minute. Okay, I'm back. So I had a customer the other day that was just all upset because they had to pay sales tax on a factory rebate. So we use the factory rebate to reduce the selling price of the vehicle. But it's just keep in mind, folks, it's just like as if you paid money down. It is taxable. You're taxed on the selling price of the vehicle minus the rebate, not the net figure after the rebate. That's just the way it works. I think the states figured this out when rebates became very prevalent in the late 70s and early 80s. They said, hold on a minute. You know, we're missing out on some revenue here. And so they figured that if they tax the rebate, make it just like down payment, just like cash out of your pocket, then, you know, the tax would be on the selling price of the vehicle. Now, if you have a trade-in, now, there may be some people out there that are listening to the show for the first time, and they are maybe have moved from some other state to here. We have a different tax system in the state of Tennessee. Our sales tax rate is high, but we have no personal income tax. Well, in business taxes we do, but there are certain taxes that we have to pay. But for the most part, we survive off of sales tax revenues. Now, when you trade a vehicle, you pay sales tax on the trading difference. You don't pay sales tax on the full sales price. You deduct the trade-in value first, and then you pay sales tax on that number. So just don't be surprised at that. If you live in the state of Tennessee and you would rather buy a car up in Virginia or Texas or someplace else that has lower sales tax rate, guess what? That doesn't work. You can't avoid the sales tax. They will collect Tennessee sales tax from you either at the dealership, especially if you have a lien on the vehicle. They are not going to trust you to register that vehicle. They are going to mail your paperwork to your local registration office to make sure that the lien gets recorded for the lender and that you pay sales tax that you're supposed to pay. So don't be naughty and try to avoid the state sales tax. Welcome to Tennessee, and I guess we'll see you tomorrow.